Hello and welcome to episode 14 of Space Talks, a science-based show with a particular interest in all things space. This is Stephen Lowry along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim, tell us of today's topic.
You bet, Steve. Well, let's say, we could say this anyway, COVID-19 is no longer a pandemic. And I think it's pretty clear. We all see that people are keen to get back out there and explore, visit new places. So today's show, we're going to look at the recent, past, and near future of space tourism going where no tour guide has gone before. And we'll be taking a quick look back at some of the comparable developments of tourism in air transport. And I think most people are aware of some of those suborbital flights that have taken up billionaires and movie stars for little short jaunts into space. But there have been other paying customers in space, and we want to hear about that too. And it begs a lot of questions about the environmental impacts. Ethical questions are raised. You've got all that space junk going up. On the other hand, some pretty significant investments are being made to turn space tourism into a new business and something that's really quite real. But let's start the show with some of those in the news updates. Steve.
Okay, I have an update, Tim, about that stunning first picture ever of a black hole taken back in 2019. 55 million light years from us is a galaxy known as M87. And at its center is a supermassive black hole, not 6,000 times as massive as our sun, not 6 million times as massive, but over 6 billion times that of our sun. Now, this black hole is known as M87 star, and in a study published last week in the Astrophysical Journal Letters, an international team of astronomers used artificial intelligence to greatly enhance that image. Now, they used a new machine learning technique called PRIMO. And you know, astronauts and scientists love acronyms. This stands for Principal Component Interferometric Modeling. And they produced a much improved picture of that black hole. Now, this sharper image of M87 star is just the start. PRIMO can also be used to sharpen up the black hole, which is at the center of our Milky Way galaxy, and it's called Sagittarius A star. And by the way, Tim, the concept of interferometers will be discussed in a future topic dealing with radio telescopes.
I'm sure that's true. I'm looking forward to that. I think we should probably make mention here of the failed Starship launch on April the 20th. Now, bad news, I suppose, is that the spacecraft exploded after 4 minutes, which isn't very long, but that's not really the big picture news here. This was the first attempt to launch the complete Starship with 33 Falcon rockets. But keep in mind the SpaceX motto itself is fail fast, learn faster. So unlike publicly funded space initiatives by NASA or what have you, SpaceX is a much different kind of beast. Rushing to get something tested is usual, analyzing the results, fixing the problems. And they believe that by this approach, you can make actual progress much faster and at a fraction of the cost. And so in this case, SpaceX suggests that their next attempt will be later this year, and they're viewing this exploding spacecraft as in fact a successful start. Now let's go on to space tourism, which is indeed linked to that Starship launch. Space tourism is a growing business, but for most people, I think if you were to say, let's talk about space tourism, they'd be saying, well, there's just a few billionaires going into space, getting sent off to the International Space Tourism for a selfie. But I'm going to say not so fast, Steve. There's a starting point here for our discussion that I think is particularly relevant. Take yourself back, or if you will, think about 1911 as the year that the Wright brothers made their historic first flight. In 1929, less than 20 years after that first launch, Lufthansa took paying customers on their first transatlantic flight. So once people and the companies involved realized that there was money to be made flying people around the globe, things actually happened very quickly. And so today on this show, we're going to go barreling down our own runway to discuss a very similar launch of space tourism. And actually, a lot has already happened in this regard, a lot of it not making the news.
Russia's space agency Roscosmos has been flying citizen astronauts to the International Space Station since 2001. The first such being Denis Tito, an American businessman who paid $20 million for that privilege of visiting the ISS. And when he got back, he had some things to say, some observations about what it takes to be such an astronaut. Let's have a listen to a clip.
I will do my best to communicate how great of an experience this is and how an ordinary person, one does not have to be superhuman to adapt to space, and it's very doable.
And since then, Roscosmos has sent six more citizen astronauts to the ISS. The cost of the trips has varied, with the most recent one costing around $52 million. In total, Roscosmos has earned over $300 million from these trips. But it's not just about the money. In fact, one citizen astronaut, Anousheh Ansari, participated in several scientific experiments while she was on board the ISS. And in 2004, along with her husband, they established the Ansari X Prize for space competition.
Okay, so there have been these citizen astronauts who have flown with Roscosmos, and they've come from countries such as South Africa, Canada, and the United States. And I wanted to note that at the time, the idea did not sit well in Washington. So I'm going to read a little bit of a quote from a press release that NASA put out when the first citizen astronaut was heading to space. While NASA does not endorse the concept of space tourism or non-professional astronauts, we do recognize that this is a decision made by the Russian government and the Russian Space Agency, and we respect their sovereign right to make such decisions.
One of those to catch a lift to the ISS was a Canadian. In September 2009, Guy Laliberté, co-founder of Cirque du Soleil, became Canada's first space tourist. Now, interestingly, Laliberté tried to write off the cost of the space flight as a work-related tax deduction. But in May 2020, Canada's Federal Court of Appeals ruled that his trip should be considered primarily personal, and as such, they taxed him on 90% of the cost of the trip. And the cost of that trip was $41,800,000.
Good for him and all that, but I'm certainly glad that Revenue Canada didn't pony up my tax dollars or yours or anyone else's to subsidize what is in effect a holiday in space. So we know that the United States and NASA in particular were not too happy when the Russians decided to sell seats to tourists for trips to the International Space Station. But as they say, times change. And part of that change is reflected by the arrival of other companies that saw an opportunity to get a foothold, generating revenue to help grow their own new businesses and their new empires in commercial space travel. Now you can think of Jeff Bezos. He's, of course, the owner of Amazon, and he was determined to get a share of this new market. He launched a firm called Blue Origin, and the spacecraft being used by that company is called the New Shepard, and I believe they've had 22 flights to date. They did have a slight mishap last year, didn't involve any personnel, but for the time being, they're sidelined till probably later this year. However, Bezos and three other citizen astronauts, including his brother, were on the first such Blue Origin suborbital flight back in 2021, and then William Shatner of Star Trek fame was on the second flight, also in 2021, and since then, I think there's been four other flights that have made this trip with citizen astronauts.
I understand his ride was a freebie as a guest of Blue Origin, but Tim, what have you learned about the paying customers and what they're getting for their money?
It's a great question, isn't it? Because we're talking about tourism and you've got to pay to go someplace, and the tickets have been ranging in price. I'm going to make an analogy with Uber, actually, and their dynamic pricing. It kind of depends who you are and whether you're going to be bringing more than cash to the launch pad. If it's just your regular rich person, billionaire, then you might pay up to $28 million on their spacecraft. It's called the New Shepard. It was named after Alan Shepard, and he made the first suborbital flight back in 1961. The new one, inside the New Shepard, there's seating for six people, and as they say in their brochure, and I'm not kidding here, ample legroom. And they boast the largest window ever to be flown in space. Now, these flights typically go up about 100 kilometers above the Earth, which is enough to give them and their customers a few minutes of weightlessness before they start their descent. But I do want to note that these spacecraft do return to Earth. They land vertically, and the spacecraft is fully reusable, which is a plus.
Yes, space, the final frontier. But just as you say, where does space start? Well, in 1957, Hungarian Theodor von Karman was the first person to attempt to calculate a theoretical limit of altitude for airplane flight and determined that limit to be 100 kilometers. So that's where space officially starts. Though it's an arbitrary line, Blue Origin can say that their customers are indeed traveling in space. And by the way, the next time that you're flying at altitude in a jetliner, you're about 10 kilometers in the sky, just 90 more to go, and you are a space tourist.
But you can't say if you've been on 10 flights, it's the same thing. It's just...
No, 10 times wait. 10 doesn't work to 100. No,
it doesn't work the same way. Now, I was wondering about what else these customers are going to get for their 28 mil on what is an 11-minute flight. What about the spacesuit, I'm thinking? Well, sorry, it's not called a spacesuit. It's just a flight suit. And before leaving the Blue Origin story, I wanted to add this little nugget. There was a wardrobe malfunction on the first flight, and it involved no other than Jeff Bezos himself. So pre-flight, maybe a week or so prior, they're posing for pre-flight photos with the crewmates. They're all decked out in their blue flight suits. Bezos is livid. He finds out that the suit made for him didn't fit well around the crotch. Very uncomfortable, apparently. And so naturally what he did is he flew in his personal tailor to make the necessary adjustments.
That reminds me of Tim, the first time I went to a tailor and he asked me if I dressed on the left or right.
Well, let's move along, shall we? Billionaires like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and until recently, Richard Branson have dominated the news about commercial space tourism. And I should note that Branson, I think, has pretty much exited stage left with his company. But the reason why we're hearing about these particular individuals and striking things the wrong way, getting people a little ticked off, is because they're linked with these famous companies and their owners are all in the media business. Being famous for doing whatever it is they do adds to their corporate branding. But I have to say, in catching up on this state of space tourism and the companies that are in it today, the one that I found most interesting, in fact, was one that I really hadn't heard of before, and it's called Axiom Space.
Well, that's a company flying below my radar as well, Tim. I've never heard of Axiom.
But it was founded in 2016 by two Americans, one of whom, I hope I get his name pronunciation right, I believe it's Michael Suffredini, was a former manager of NASA's own International Space Station program. Since then, the company has had quite the trajectory. Now, that's going to go over that for you. The first major project they were contracted to undertake was to build and deploy the first privately funded space station. And initially, the modules built are to hook up to the aging ISS, and then, as the ISS is slated to return to Earth, these new modules will deploy separately and become a privately funded space station. Overall, Axiom Space is aiming to revolutionize, this is their promotional way of saying things, revolutionize the way humans access and utilize space by providing affordable and sustainable commercial space flight services. There are four modules planned, Steve, and the first one is to launch in 2025. The first will create new living space at the ISS for their crew. The second planned to be a 6-meter spherical inflatable module, and it's going to become the first entertainment studio in space. The plans are, among others, to deploy this to make a Tom Cruise movie.
Well, I just read today that the Russians have just released the very first maiden space movie, but I'm sure it won't hold a candle to a Tom Cruise movie. And say, have I ever mentioned that Tom Cruise used to attend a school in Ottawa where I was the vice principal? And at that time, he was known as Little Tommy Maypother, but that's for another story.
I don't know whether we can wait for that one, Steve, but I'm gonna try. So we get a little sidetracked by the Hollywood glitz. Let's go back to Axiom. It also has, in practice today as we speak, a commercial astronaut training program. So they understand that the demand for people going to space is sufficiently great. The demand for other spacecraft, commercial spacecraft, is so great that they need to start training commercial astronauts. The commander of the next mission that Axiom has going to the ISS in, just weeks from now, The commander is going to be Peggy Whitson. This is one of the most experienced former American astronauts. She has logged over 600 days in space on three distinct flights. And also along in this upcoming flight will be two paying customers from Saudi Arabia.
That's quite the story. And what a sign of how we've turned the corner. The private sector has concluded that the volume of future space flights is so great and the revenue potential so significant that there is already a need to start training commercial astronauts. And we're back with today's topic of space tourism. And without a doubt, the billionaire who led the way on mass-produced electric vehicles, Elon Musk, is now doing the same when it comes to space tourism and his company, SpaceX. Now, Tim, you mentioned how different his company has been in comparison to NASA or Roscosmos by incorporating a conceptual paradigm shift in willing to fail fast to learn faster. They've had a number of spectacular failures along the way, but they're also far ahead of the competition in terms of successful flights. And in 2023, they've already conducted 24 successful launches. And it seems that a key factor in all of this has been the reusable first stage boosters, which independently return to the launch pad with 185 out of 196 attempts in doing so. And that's an astonishing 94% success rate. And as you mentioned, Tim, the recent first attempt of the SpaceX Starship shouldn't be seen as a failure, a point underlined by Canada's Chris Hadfield when interviewed on CNN. Hadfield was ecstatic about the successful launch and minutes of flight before something did go wrong, as valuable technical data was obtained to ensure future successes. And incidentally, NASA has already contracted SpaceX for the next lunar landing flight, which is called Artemis 4. So Elon Musk presumably sees that forthcoming lunar trip as an important conceptual validation, but that's actually small potatoes, as his Starship was intended from the get-go to be the spacecraft that will take astronauts and tourists to the planet Mars.
It's incredible, but that's entirely the case. And I'm going to agree with you there, Steve. As we mentioned earlier, Axiom Space, they're now paying SpaceX to take their customers to the ISS. And that revenue stream is surely going to continue and be a useful stream of revenue for Axiom. Now, I know that you're far too modest to bring this next little fact to the table, but you have what I'm going to call your own space tourism adventure. And this is the time, Steve. Let's share the details on this amazing little nugget.
If forced, I shall. I do have a little something to offer. Dear listeners, I have been in space. Or shall I clarify, my face has been in space aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery on STS-133, which launched in February 2011. NASA encouraged the public to submit a JPEG self-portrait prior to launch, which was put aboard the space shuttle before its trip to the International Space Station, 354 kilometers above the Earth. Subsequently, each participant, such as myself, received a color certificate. In short, mine says, "This certifies the face of Stephen Lowry has flown in space aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery to the International Space Station." And guess what? That didn't cost me $20 million. It didn't cost me a cent.
That's pretty good value, Steve, and I'm sure you know the line, "I've got a face for radio." Well, in this case, it seems as though you have a face for space.
And every time I look in the mirror, I'm reminded of that. There is one final space tourist venture, Tim, and it's sending cremated remains into space. Business being business, there are various price points for ballistic suborbital trips, temporary orbital trips, permanent orbital trips, or even one-way trips to deep space. Now, one such company is Celestis Memorial Space Flights, created in 1994. And their literature says, quote, "Whether you're looking to celebrate the life of your loved one or plan your own journey, you can trust Celestis to provide a truly mind-blowing space memorial amongst the stars." And is it pricey? Well, you be the judge, as it's going to cost you $2,500 to put a mere 5 grams of cremated remains, you or your loved one, into a suborbital flight, and they market that as the Earthrise. Now, there are pricier options for Earth orbit and Luna, and yes, that one goes to the moon.
It's crazy that we're talking about it, but it makes sense in the context of today's show. You know, what were those people thinking when they came up with this idea? Were they high? I mean, what were they doing when they thought, hey, I've got a great idea?
We know what they were thinking, Tim. Cha-ching.
Cha-ching. Cha-ching. Well, today, Steve, we've had a bit of a discussion about tourism, and there's been debates around actual tourism, terrestrial tourism, for quite some time now. And a lot of the criticisms are similar between the two formats, and they typically raise some ethical questions. Now, they're a little bit different when it comes to space tourism, or perhaps they're just beginning to get a little bit louder. And so I thought we should end this section of the show by talking a little bit about these discussions or debates. You've got this astronaut tourist class, as we speak, that's limited to the super rich or super famous. The odd family member has been along for a ride. I think in our research, we found that Alan Shepard's daughter was given a lift on Blue Origin. Now, one of the arguments is naturally that the fortunes that are being spent by these already privileged humans to get into space, it's rather obscene when you think of the poverty left here on the ground, the illness, the environmental challenges that we're facing, and yet all this incredible fortunes are being spent on these little suborbital flights or what have you. And the risks that are being taken to turn billionaires into astronauts, they're real as well. It's not just the people on board the spacecraft that are at risk of a failure. There's a lot of ground crew that are at risk. Workers often die in the production of materials and projects of this sort. And those lives are lost for what reason? To give somebody a free ride in space or bragging rights or a selfie or get to call themselves an astronaut. So there's some pretty solid thinking, I think, that goes into the criticisms when it comes to the growing space tourism business.
Well, yes, and that's the problem. The ethics of going into space is similar to any cost-benefit analysis with morality attached to it. If we want to do, let's say, the analogy of safari hunting, which only the very rich could do 150 years ago or so, well, middle-class people can go on a safari. But if you take a look at all the ancillary support groups that are associated with those and the scale of economies of people that derive their living from people going on safari, I guess you could say that there's a benefit to them. On the minus side, what encroachment is there on animal life when they do that? Similarly, what encroachment is there into going into space? Well, as you mentioned earlier, there's all the space junk which is floating around. And something that we're going to have to talk about in a little more detail on another episode is the impact of the actual launch itself. Now, the launch the other day of the SpaceX Starship, I just read, created a tremendous dust storm in the community surrounding the spot in Texas where it took off from. Now, the Starship had a boost of twice that of the largest ever rocket before, which was successful, and that's the Saturn V. The Soviets did have a proton booster that blew up 3 times, and so they dropped that program. But this particular one was blowing chunks of concrete the size of basketballs about as well. So not only is the immediate debris which is being thrust about, there's also the plume of smoke which is generated. So when you see a jet flying at altitude across the sky and you see the contrail, you have some people who are conspiracy theorists saying that they're chemtrails, not contrails. Well, we know very well it's basically water condensation. But nonetheless, there is, if nothing else, visual pollution. And so we'll have to take a look at the kind of rocket propellants that are being used, because there are different ones. Interested viewers, go on YouTube and take a look at one of China's Long March rockets. You will not see white plumes of smoke. You'll see orangey brown stuff coming out because they're using a very toxic hypergolic fuel. And we'll talk more about that another time. At any rate, let's have a listen to William Shatner's audio clip when he talks about his experience of going up into space and how it affected him.
You know, prior to going up there, lying in that chair, trying to think of something clever to say when I came out, when, you know, if everything worked and I see the little blue orb and I was trying to think of something clever to say, and then we get up, and when I was there, everything I thought might be clever to say went out the window because the experience going at 2,500 miles an hour, breaking through this little thin blue skin that surrounds Earth that provides us with life. We broke through that with the count of one or two at 2,500 miles an hour, and the skin is 50 miles thick. Broke through, and all of a sudden, the blue is down below, and the blackness of space. Now, space is interesting. The universe lies there. But at that moment, in that big window, it was only black and ominous, and that was death, and this was life, and everything else just stood still for a moment. I was overwhelmed with the experience, with it, with the sensation of looking at death and looking at life, and this, you know, what's become a cliche of how we need to take care of the planet, but it's so fragile. People say, "Oh, it's fragile." No, no, no. There's this little tiny blue skin that is 50 miles wide, and we pollute it, and it's our means of living. I was struck so profoundly by it.
Well, Tim, he's not the only citizen astronaut to make this point, though with his fame and oratorical skills, he might have been the one to have made best the case for space tourism. What's your own take on this, Tim?
Well, I have to say I am a little bit torn and appreciative of the arguments of concern about the environmental footprint. However, I would point out that there is going to be no stopping the commercialization of space, the potential riches of mining on the moon, for example, or mining asteroids. If there are going to be people flying in space, I think that lends itself to the environment for the kind of regulations, kind of transparency and scrutiny that will make this a kind of a greener, potentially greener. I certainly think that when you listen to William Shatner, and as you said, Steve, he's not the only one to have made that kind of observation, even dating back to 1968, when the first Apollo astronauts delivered that moving speech when they circled the moon in December around Christmas time and were making their own observations. These are not unimportant messages. And they are certainly reminders. Whether they're effective or not, maybe that's above my pay grade. But my goodness, it is a tough question to say I'm all down on one side or the other. But I think that's all the time we're going to have today to talk about this ethical question, which, of course, isn't going anywhere. It was fun for us to do the research. And until next time, when our topic will be Destination Mars, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long. And we'll see you next time on Space Talks.